Music and Booze with Mo is produced and distributed by Eats Drinks TV, a service of the Center for Culinary Culture, home of the Cocktail Collection, and First Reel Entertainment, and is available wherever fine podcasts can be heard. The Center for Culinary Culture, telling the story of food and drink, one taste at a time. Welcome to Music and Booze with Mo. I'm Mo Herms, and I've worked in the music industry most of my life, so have met some pretty amazing musicians over the years. I also love a good cocktail, and I've encountered some really interesting bartenders as well. It seems that there is a lot of crossover, so when I can, I like to talk to musicians and bartenders about music and booze. Join us at the bar, won't you? Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by The Mermaid, a cozy neighborhood bar with an aquatic flair in the Little Tokyo area of downtown LA. Open 7 days a week, featuring tropical cocktails and snacks, The Mermaid also has a daily happy hour from 5 to 8 p.m. Follow The Mermaid on Instagram at TheMermaidLA to hear about upcoming events and check them out at TheMermaidLA.com. Head to 428 East 2nd Street, Los Angeles, for a drink. So excited about this one, and you're going to know why in just a minute, because today I'm talking to the senior gin ambassador for Beam Suntory. That would be Kelly Rivers. Kelly has a passion for food and drink that is just deeply ingrained in her entire being, but also a passion for music. And at some point she found herself in the Bay Area and she opened up Whitechapel, which was the temple of gin, leading the world as a temple of gin until one opened in Asia that just kind of rivals it. And during that time, she found herself volunteering at KALX Berkeley, which was the same radio station I worked at. I was operations manager, she became music director. So we've followed very similar paths into the world of music and booze. So sit back and relax, you're going to hear all about gin, so many things about gin, but also so many things about music. And, you know, that's just what we do.
Introduce yourself, tell everyone who you are and what you do in this whole world of gin, etc.
Yeah, 100%. Hello, my name is Kelly Rivers. I am the senior gin ambassador for Beam Suntory, which basically is a fancy term of saying my job is to drink, talk, and teach people about gin, and specifically Sipsmith Gin and Larios and Roku. If you're unfamiliar with those gins, then I've got some words with you, and feel free to reach out to me at any time, because it is a subject besides music that I would like to wax poetically about, basically until I bore you and you just want to do whatever I say to shut me up.
I'm going to tell you a story. It's going to crack you up because it relates to what you just said. When Whitechapel was being built, I think I was still in LA for a couple of years. I happened to be at this bar called The Varnish, which you probably know. And I was in there and Martin Kate happened to be in town and I didn't know he was in town and I ran into him there. And I was like, hey, what's going on? What are you doing here? Oh, I was just doing a little lecture on some, you know, some rum stuff for somebody. They invited me down. I'm like, great, how's it going with Whitechapel? And at the time it was a little delayed, as all bars, new bars are. You have a shoot target date that never quite works out.
Yes, so, we call that a hopening.
Yes. Exactly. So I said, hey, you know, I know it's a little bit delayed. He goes, yeah, it'll get there. I said, well, I can't wait to check it out, but I have to be honest with you, I'm not really much of a gin person. I said this to Martin. I said, you know, I've just, my experiences haven't been the best, but you know, I'm willing to go try. And he just looked at me and he said, really? I go, yeah, I'm just not into gin. He goes, you will be. Looked deeply into my eyes and just said, you will be. And I was like, oh my God. So it was open by that fall. And I went up and I'd let him know, I'm doing it. I'm coming up. I'm going to come to Whitechapel. I'm so excited to see it. And I walked in there and he was there and he's like, okay, we're going to take care of you. You're going to have things that treat you well. You're going to be okay. And I'm like, I believe you, because there's 2 million bottles of gin here. Something here has to not give me a headache or make me feel weird. And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience, as you know, because you were part of that, right?
Yeah, I was their first employee hired. Mm-hmm. They gave me a fancy title called Ginosaur, which when I looked to Martin, I'm like, you just make me sound like a drunk dinosaur. I'm okay with that. I've been called worse, but my job at Whitechapel was just to talk to people, to get them over that first, like that resistance somehow, that people have grown up, whether through experience or that they lived or what they perceived. Mm-hmm. And basically say, hey, look, you know, you might have had a not great experience with gin or you're in love with it, but the reason there are so many gins out there is there's one for everybody. And when I was hired, I talked to Martin and the other two owners and I was like, look, I'm going to curate your gin list. I'm going to like educate the staff and the consumer and anybody else. I'll represent Whitechapel, mm-hmm. wherever I go. But here's my question for you. And at the time, Atlas in Singapore hadn't opened yet, which is the bar in Singapore, Atlas, has the largest gin selection in the world.
Yeah.
And so at that time, Whitechapel did when we opened. Mm-hmm. We opened up with like 380. And by the time I left, it was roughly around 800.
Wow.
Different labels of gin. And I basically asked them, I'm like, do you want to have all of the gin or do you want it to be a curated list of gin? Because mm-hmm. there's differences. Mm-hmm. And they said curated. I'm like, cool, I'm here for it. Also, my personal collection will always be bigger. That's just I just let them know. I'm like, that's just the way it's going to be. So when I left and I was offered the role that I'm currently in with educating people about SipSmith, I had to move myself from San Francisco, which is where I was living at the time and was working in hospitality for 18 years up to that point. To New York for this new job, I had to move myself because it's illegal to move alcohol across state lines. And at that time, I couldn't get any moving company to believe I had 1,300 bottles of olive oil. You weren't going to believe it. So my friend and I rented a 17-foot truck and took 5 days to drive across the country. Had a great playlist for it, which you have to at that time.
Oh yeah.
We got a flat tire in Oklahoma, actually 2 tires out at like 1 a.m. But I also, when we landed in, cause we were delayed by 2 days, it happened to be the first year of BCB. So Berlin Bar Convent, which the most famous one is in Berlin. So this one's the first year they did in Brooklyn. And all my friends who agreed, because, you know, coming from San Francisco, you move yourself. Like, that's just what it is. Mm-hmm. That's not how it is in New York. You don't move yourself.
No.
You hire somebody, which I was too stubborn to do. So my first apartment in Bed-Stuy, which is on the other side of where I live now, was a fourth floor walk-up.
Oh, my God.
Had so many friends that were willing to move me, except we were 2 days delayed, and it was the start of BCB. So all my bartender friends flaked out. And I had one very dear friend who was there the entire time.
Oh my God.
He wouldn't take money, but I gifted him a bottle of Pappy 13 year. And I also gift him a bottle of Heaven Hill whiskey from the 1940s as payment.
Wow. Oh my God. So
we did the 4-4 walk up. I had to, for 2 weeks, lift myself on and off the toilet. My legs hurt so bad.
I believe you. My God, that sounds horrible. So, I thought moving records was bad.
So the funny thing is, when I was living in Oakland at that time before I mm-hmm. moved, I had a hard thing. Because I have two loves, you know, gin and music, mm-hmm. and I had a collection of both. So do I move the 1,300 bottles of gin, which is part of my livelihood, mm-hmm. What I would be doing, or do I move the 7,000 records? I could not keep both. And it was hard. Like, what do you do? So I found a very dear friend who was opening up a bar in Tahoe, mm-hmm. A Pioneer Club in Tahoe. And he is holding on to my vinyl.
Wow.
As part of the core of his bar and restaurant.
Wow.
So if you ever go,
I was going to say,
say hi
to your records.
And I'm looking at them longingly.
Wow. That is amazing. Well, we have to roll back and discuss how you came to be a person with this intensive of a gin collection. You know, when did it start? It's like the music thing almost seems easy. It's like people who love music have like always loved music. They like came out of the womb loving music and stuff. Yeah. But and that may or may not have been the case for you, but usually it kind of is. But the falling in love with gin to this extent, like, how did that happen to you? You're gonna have to roll back.
Yeah, well, slowly and all at once. No. So my grandparents, paternal and maternal, are from the South, Georgia, mm-hmm. Mississippi, and Alabama. Mm-hmm. And you know, at the time when the sun was out, you drank gin, and when the sun went down, you drank whiskey. That's kind of how it was. Mm-hmm. My great aunt Liz, who you'll hear about during this whole conversation, because I quote her often. Her and my uncle Buddy did not have any kids, and they taught me how to make mixed drinks when I was 7. She taught me how to make mixed drinks. She taught me how to play cards, and she also taught me how to curse and swear.
That is
usually
a proper aunt.
The same time.
That is a proper aunt. Yeah. That's, if my brother and sister had kids, I would be that aunt. You know.
So I always loved that. I loved that. I grew up in Europe. I did my internship for culinary school in Asia. But I've always loved the history of food and drinks. I just loved every aspect. I love that it wasn't a corporate job where I had to sit behind a desk. I hated waking up in the morning. You know, I was that kid on Christmas morning that my older sister would come and say, Santa's been here. And I'm like, Santa will be there when I'm ready to get up. Like, I hate waking up in the morning. So I knew that, you know, whatever office job or whatever was not something that I wanted to do. So I wanted to be a race car driver. Mm. Grew up in Germany on the Autobahn, wanted to be a race car driver. My parents were like, no way in hell that's going to happen. So my second love was food. When I lived in Europe, we were fortunate enough, the dollar was very strong in the 80s. And so we got to eat at some really amazing Michelin 2 and 3 star restaurants. And I was a kid and there was no cell phones, there was no games, mm-hmm. there was no toys. Mm-hmm. You sat for 5 hours with adults and you didn't say anything.
Wow.
So the only thing I could do was get up to go to the bathroom. And after the third time, my mother or my older sister was too tired to take me to the bathroom. So they thought I knew where it was and I could go on my own. And I remember I was at one of the top rated restaurants in France, the Auberge de Ile. Mm-hmm. And I got lost on my way to the bathroom and I found myself in the kitchen. Mm. And I was like this little redhead with like this nice dress, like completely like shocked. My parents are going to kill me. I got lost going to the bathroom. I'll never be able to escape the table again. But what they did was someone saw me. They gave me some chocolate from the patisserie. Ooh. And sent me on my way. So I'm like, ooh, chocolate.
You're going to get lost more often.
I'm going to get lost every time. But what I did was I fell in love with the dance. I fell in love with the movement and the rhythm. And it is rhythmic once you're in the kitchen. That was very quiet except for the clinks and the things and the sprays and the you know, and the slight talking. And it was just this marvelous dance that I fell in love with. And I just happened to be at the time kind of good at it. So when I couldn't be a race car driver and I knew I didn't want a corporate job, or, you know, I also didn't want to go to college because I would have to pay for it. And there was, it just didn't interest me. Mm-hmm. So I decided to be a chef. And this was before like the Chef Network or Top Chef. So cooking was something you did while you were paying your way through college, mm-hmm. which is what my parents thought. Mm-hmm. And so I went to culinary school because my parents thought I needed a degree of some sort. So I went to culinary school in San Francisco, did my internship in Tokyo, where I got my first bartending job. And the reason I got a bartending job was because the cooking was an internship and didn't pay in Japan, even in the late mm-hmm. 90s, was mm-hmm. very expensive. So mm-hmm. I got a job cocktail waitressing in Roppongi, which is the club district of Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And basically the bar was called Gas Panic. And they had three locations in Roppongi. And you could be 16 to get in. And the rule was you had to have a drink in your hand to stay. So my job as a cocktail person was to have a sign around my torso mm-hmm. and a flashlight that had drinks on it.
Oh my God.
Languages. And this is not Japanese cocktailing that we think of now. It's not mm-hmm. high five. It was
this big is just pure club stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. The big ingredient that hit Tokyo at that time was Galliano.
Oh my God.
And I will say,
it has a place.
Hardwood wall bangers made with gin are delicious. I'm going to say that right now. They're delicious. So my job was to tap people on the shoulders while they were dancing on the dance floor, illuminate my chest, and like have them point what they wanted. And then I would go to the bar and they would make the drink and I would give it to them and then they would pay me. And that was my job.
Wow. Well,
so super, super high-end bartending here. But what ended up happening was, a few months into it, my internship, I got a hot iron dropped on my arm.
Oh my God.
And I got third-degree burn and I had to go burn cream, the whole thing. Called out of work for a week because of the, you know, kitchens and burns, not super.
Yeah.
But I was told if I didn't go to my cocktailing shifts, I would lose the job. So I showed up and it was at that point the hottest day in Tokyo that year.
Oh.
It's underground, it's sweaty, and my arm was itchy.
Oh God.
So I took off the bandage and it was a giant blister from basically my elbow to my palm. But at least it was cooler. And I remember, and to this day, I still hate this song.
Oh no.
It was Chumbawamba, Thump Thumping.
The tub thumping, yeah.
Yeah, tub thumping. And everyone's jumping up and down. And I hand this gentleman his vodka and soda. And as he's jumping up and down, he spills the vodka soda on my blister, on my burn. I start to scream because alcohol.
Oh God.
And it's so loud in there. He has no idea. It's dark. And so he just shakes his hand on me, takes the back of his arm and proceeds to wipe off the offending spilled drink and my blisters.
Oh my God. I am aching inside right now.
Yeah.
Oh God.
So this is the first time I ever threw somebody out of a club or a bar or establishment. I then proceeded to go behind the bar and put my arm under tepid water.
Yeah.
Oh. To cool it down. The manager was like, since you're back here, you need to start making drinks.
Oh my God. Like,
all right. The tickets are coming up in kanji. And I'm like, cool. So
it's like literal trial by fire.
Yeah. So what ends up happening is my next shift, I go into the locker where my menu board, so to speak, is there and it's gone. I think I'm fired. Mm-hmm. I go to the manager. I'm like, I am so sorry. Like the burn. And he's like, no, you're way better behind the bar than you're on the floor. So you're bartending. And that was my first bartending shift.
Oh my God.
My first bartending job. And since then, when I, you know, I traveled through Asia and South America, and when I came back, finally came back to San Francisco to start my culinary career, mm-hmm. I always bartended on the side because I loved it. It was a break from the kitchen, and honestly, it paid better.
Mm-hmm. Je ne veux pas travailler. Je ne veux pas déjeuner. Je veux seulement oublier. Et puis je fume. Déjà j'ai connu le parfum de l'amour. Un million de roses n'embaumerait pas autant. Maintenant une seule fleur dans mes entourages me rend malade.
It hasn't answered the question of how I got into gin. But so
got you into bartending. That's
got into bartending.
I mean, technically, Great Aunt Liz got you into bartending, but that was like,
well, got me into understanding the power of the cocktail.
Yes.
So I was working in kitchens and some of the highest end like restaurants in San Francisco and Oakland. I did stages at like Shaped Knees. I worked in private houses like the Gettys. You know, I worked. The Facebook wedding, Google wedding. Like I've been very fortunate in my culinary career and then bartended on the side. Mm-hmm. And then I got, you know, 10, 12 years into it, I got burned out.
Yeah.
As you do.
Yeah.
So I was working at a bar in Albany, California, which is by Berkeley.
Tell me you were working at the Hotsy Totsy.
Oh, yeah. That comes later.
Okay. Was my home bar when I lived there. I lived around the block.
At the time, I was working at Fonda. So when Fonda opened up on Solano, it was a award-winning Latin American bar. Mm-hmm. But the drinks, you know, this is the early aughts. So this mm-hmm. new bartender came in, and it was all fresh ingredients in the kitchen. This was like mm-hmm. the fresh ingredients revolution that was coming into the U.S. So. Mm-hmm. You know, Bourbon and Branch hadn't opened yet, but it was like very close. But so Cesar's was our biggest competition for mm-hmm. cocktail bars mm-hmm. up on Shattuck, right next to Chez Panisse. And they were doing like classic cocktails with fresh ingredients, like lime and lemon juice instead of roses cordial. So I was working in the kitchen, and the bar manager at the time had a crush on me and offered me some shifts behind the bar. But he was one of those bartenders that were using like artificial flavors. So a Latin restaurant with amazing food and French martinis. This is the era of V is for variety mm-hmm. and the teeny, whatever, mm-hmm. the chocolate teeny. This So the bartenders and the chefs despised him. Thought he was awful, didn't care about what went with the food or what the consumer wanted. It was about his ego. He also wore those Ed Hardy shirts, and thank God.
Oh, Lord, no.
To identify assholes before they open their mouth.
Totally. Right? Totally.
So we called them Flames because he always wore those flame shirts. So anyway, we staged a coup and we overthrew him. And my friend and I became bar managers. I left the kitchen for a time. To focus on the bar. And we started understanding tequila and rum and cachaça and pisco, because it was a Latin themed restaurant. Yeah. The company, which was part of Lalim's at the time, opened up a seafood restaurant on San Pablo and called Sea Salt. So we had that one to be vodka and gin based because it goes better with sea salt. And then they opened up a barbecue place right on Gilman called T-Rex. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which was American whiskey. And at the time we wanted to have the biggest American whiskey collection in the Bay Area that only was American whiskey. So you had like you had like Nihon, which the owner just passed away, which is super sad. But we had Nihon and Bourbon and Branch and Rick House just opened up, but they had like lots of scotches because American whiskey and bourbons weren't really big. You had your Jamesons and you had your scotches and a little Japanese, but not much. So working at T-Rex, we really wanted to find smaller distilleries, American distilleries. So we found like Willett, and we found Rowan's Creek and Heaven Hill, and we were one of the first bars that got Buffalo Trace in, which wasn't at the time. When I moved, I found that menu, and we were selling Pappy Van Winkle 20 year for $9 for 2 weeks, which was expensive, right?
Yeah, so yeah.
Bullet 24 year old rye for $8 for 2 ounces, right? Mm-hmm. So if I ever time machine, I'm saving the whiskey. Screw everything. But a lot of these smaller American whiskey brands were making gin while they're liquid aged, because they're buying the liquid from MPG, and they had it because the stills aren't made for vodka, which was still very big. Mm-hmm. They would make gin. So one of my things while working at TRX was trying to get whiskey drinkers to drink something that wasn't their shot of choice that they drank since college. Yeah. Hopefully they weren't drinking underage and their parents drank and their parents drank. So first of all, I was trying to like, hey, mm-hmm. just because it's not Jim Beam, Maker's Mark, or Jack Daniels doesn't mean that's not good. So I had to get them to try something new. Mm-hmm. Then my next thing was get them to try cocktails. And at that time, I couldn't pay anyone to order an old fashioned, mm-hmm. right? Beers and shots. So then I'm like, okay, let's try cocktails. So Zazarax, Vucarays, you know? Mm-hmm. So then I got them into understanding cocktails, craft cocktails, and then I talked to all these whiskey people about gin. Mm-hmm. And they're like, wait, what? And I'm like, yeah, so it's kind of like whiskey, but a little bit flavored and not aged. It's perfect. And they're like, what are you telling me? And so basically I had to tell them that you have to drink the gin to get the whiskey. Mm-hmm. Because if you mm-hmm. can't get them to have money while they're waiting for their stuff to age, they're never going to release the whiskey. Mm-hmm. And that is how I got to talk about gin. I had to talk to people that didn't want to drink gin, that didn't like to drink gin, and were whiskey people. And that's where I started to get the history. And I started to collect because I got access to smaller portfolios and smaller whiskey brands. And they're like, oh, they're making this gin. I'm like, well, I like gin. I like history. I like classic cocktails. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where it started. So that was a really long answer to a very short question.
Yeah, but it gets the whole history down in there. I mean, and especially knowing your culinary background, that I think, you know, and what I know of the spirits world over the years almost lends itself more to gin than almost anything else. I mean, gin is so varied. It's such an insane category. There's so much there. There's so much that goes into it. There's so many different gins out there.
Yeah, that my personal collection has grown from the 1300 that I moved to, we're a little under 2300 different labels in my small bedroom apartment, wow. 2-bedroom apartment.
Wow, that's nuts. So, but also amazing. So I'm guessing, you know, you've now gotten to the East Bay and everything. And when did Calyx come into it? Because I have to say, I am absolutely thrilled. You are the first person I've talked to who's a Calyx person. I'm like, we are of the same radio station, you know, so we both worked there. I was just before you. And it's when you were talking about the Albany thing, I lived in Albany the last 9 years. I was in the Bay Area. I left in 2001, late 2001.
Nice. Yeah.
And then went back in 2011 and lived there till 2014. And actually, I don't know if you knew Kitty English.
Oh, I know Kitty. Yeah.
Okay.
Kitty's, yeah.
It was Kitty's. Now it's Price Fighter.
Yeah, I remember when Kitty's opened.
I was there. I helped her open that bar.
Have been on one mm-hmm. side of the bar and we just didn't know it.
Yeah, I went up and that was one of those early, she was just like, we're only using fresh ingredients. I spent days with her, like, you know, cutting mint and slicing oranges and you know, all this because she was getting all the prep ready for that in the days leading up to it. And there for her opening night. And actually she moved to Brazil and I bought her house. And that's why I lived in Berkeley, was because I bought her house.
I've had my hair cut in that house.
Yes. And that is where we were talking about cats. My soul cat is there. So I actually was okay with leaving him there because the house had such a long history. And then when I moved away, the couple that bought it were punk rockers that met at Gilman Street. And I'm like, I'm trying to keep music in this house as long as I can.
It's in the foundation.
It's absolutely. So yeah. So, I mean, it's like I'd go up there and, did you ever know a guy named David Visick?
Yep.
Yep. Okay. So David, his wife and I are very good friends and we would go to Cesar and have drinks. It's like, I mean, anytime I'd come up, we went to all these places that you're talking about. So I know all of them. I just wasn't living there. So we definitely crossed paths. However, the Calyx thing, when did you start there?
So, like any good person who wants to avoid hard questions in their lives or trauma that has come about, you just keep piling stuff on.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So at the time I was bartending one or two different places. I was a full-time line cook. I was a part-time pastry chef. I was helping this organization called LUPEC, Ladies United for the Preservation of the Endangered Cocktail. Kind of get off the ground in the Bay Area. I joined the bartender, USBG, United States Bartenders Guild. I had my own pop-up, monthly brunch pop-up at another Calix alumni's house because they had a better house for it. And I decided that that wasn't enough because the deep thoughts were still like invading every portion. Mm-hmm. And I needed to do something for me, mm-hmm. something that I was really enjoyed that didn't have a paycheck attached to it. And mm-hmm. knowing that Calix was community as well as student, you didn't have to be a student of the college to do it. So I started as a music reviewer. Mm-hmm. And when Sean was the station manager.
Sean and Mona. And then Mona. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then Mona at the time was the music director. Mm-hmm. And since I was not a student, I was deemed as a little bit more responsible.
Mm-hmm. A little more reliable
mm-hmm. responsible. Yeah. And I just loved the music. I loved everything about it. I even loved the fact that the library was not cataloged. I loved mm-hmm. all of it. And I was probably, when I became music director with my best friend at the time, Benji, mm-hmm. Lawless is his mm-hmm. middle name. So he went by Lawless. I was the first music director that did not have my own radio show. Like, I hadn't even gone through training. Like, the radio was like the last piece of it. I didn't mm-hmm. want, like, it wasn't ever part of me until they're like, hey, as music director, you should probably do a show. You probably should do a show. So I was the music director for 4 years. My on-air DJ name was Jelly Bean. Mm-hmm. I started every show with Shonen Knife. They want to eat jelly beans every show. I just loved every aspect of it. I loved the fact that I got to go to CMJ in New York, which is where I got a lot of my bearings now that I live in New York. Mm-hmm. I still walk around. I'm like, I saw this show there and mm-hmm. this show there and this show there. And got to go to South by Southwest in the heydays when the wristbands were still only $60.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Music was always part of everything I did. I always, when I walk around, what would the soundtrack be if this was an important piece of my life? Like, what song would it be? Where would I see this going? You know, when I hear a song, it always brings me back to a time and place. Mm-hmm. Very much like food and drink.
Yeah. God, you know, 4 years is a long run to be music director over there.
Yeah. 4 years was a lot.
I'm trying to think when I was there, you know, there were some people who did it 2 years, maybe three. I'm sure somebody did it for a long time, but I was there for 10 years, just over 10 years at Calix and had various roles. Don't remember anyone doing it for that long, but you were someone I never met, but knew of. Oh, Jelly Bean. Yeah, Jelly Bean. It's like, you know, through mutual friends, or if I'd be up there, you happen to be on the radio, you know, when I was driving through. As soon as I was within range, I'm like, I'm here, I'm listening to Calix, because there is no radio station like it to me, at least on the West Coast. You're out there, you've got the WFMU, if you want to try it.
Not having a car really does limit the amount of radio I listen to.
Yeah, true. Mm-hmm. But that library, man. When I left Calix, I couldn't remember what I owned and what was in the library. Don't I have this record? Oh, it's at the Calix library.
There's still some albums. Like, I'm like, man, I wish I had that. Like, mm-hmm. just, you know, and this was just right at the beginning of like digital. Like, when I was leaving was like, and it was still this weird gray area. Can we have digital archives in the library? Can we not?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was hard. It was me leaving or stepping away from Calyx was a very difficult decision. My bartending had kind of taken off. I was being pulled in a lot of directions, but it was mostly, it felt that the world was moving forward, especially in this digital space. And we were being, the station was kind of being held at, you know, those golden handcuffs of what is legal and what we want to do and what is safe to do and not making waves. And it was at a point in my life that I wanted to make waves. Yeah. I wanted to fight. I was asking a lot of whys, not just in at the station and, but also in my life. And I remember I had a show and I was playing Detachable Penis by King Missile. And the station director came in and told me while the song was playing that I had to stop. It did not go against any FCC laws. And I was just, that was kind of it for me. I was like, that's cool. That's the way you want to run the station. I understand. That's just not what I want.
I asked them to check the medicine cabinet because for some reason I leave it there sometimes, but not this time. So I told them if it pops up to let me know. I called a few people who were at the party, but they were no help either. I was starting to get desperate. I really don't like being without my penis for too long. It makes me feel like less of a man, and I really hate having to sit down every time I take a leak. After a few hours of searching the house and calling everyone I could think of, I was starting to get very depressed, so I went to the Kiev and ate breakfast. Then as I walked down 2nd Avenue towards St. Mark's Place, where all those people sell used books and other junk on the street, I saw my penis lying on a blanket next to a broken toaster oven. Some guy was selling it. I had to buy it off him. He wanted $22, but I talked him down to $17.
Now, do you play music at all, or you're just a music nerd? You just love this stuff. I can't see you having time for that, honestly.
So I was trained in the Suzuki method for violin, viola, cello.
Whoa. Okay.
So for 14 years.
That's intense. That's very intense.
I still can't play by ear. I'm great at reading music.
Wow. That's very intense. Yeah. See, I kind of got into radio because, despite the guitar you can see behind me, I knew I was never going to be able to play music well, but I loved it so much. I thought, how can I support it? What can I do? And I could DJ and I could interview artists, and I did the music journalism route. So I interviewed people all the time. So when I do these interviews with folks, what I hear so often is that the musicality of being behind the bar, of being in the kitchen, of how it is a dance, of how people have to, you have to learn the rhythms of everyone else. And I hear people say often, it's like being in a band, being behind the bar, because you learn how to work with each other, who each other's strengths are, and you bounce off each other. And then it creates this atmosphere, you know?
100%. And so in my, you know, sadistic training methods, because I've opened 30 bars and restaurants in my 28 years.
Oh my God.
But I always love, one of my favorite things, I love training bar backs. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you usually get bar backs pretty raw and like moldable. Mm-hmm. And when I was training bar backs, when I was the bar manager at the Hotsy Totsy for 5 years, one of my tricks, and, you know, we didn't have an HR department, so that might have been one of the reasons why it stayed, was I would have a spray bottle on me. Mm-hmm. And one of the first shifts a bar back would do, and I would have them for like 3 hours, just walk, and it's a very small bar, just walk from one end of the bar to the other end of the bar. Mm-hmm. Don't touch anything. Don't, like, just keep walking back and forth while I bartend. And every time you run into me, I spray you with a water bottle. Definitely not something that we could do now, but that's what I would do. Because if a bar back or somebody that you're working with behind a bar, and especially a very narrow bar, which was what Hotsy Totsy's bar was, if you can do your thing and while I'm doing my thing and not run into each other, and it's muscle memory, everything else is teachable. Mm-hmm. Like knowing the spatial awareness of the people that you work side by side very quickly, very intensely, where mm-hmm. people are staring at you and they want something from you within 2 minutes, while you're doing five other things at the same time, once you have that down, everything else is easy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. When all this time of you running bars, opening bars, behind the bar, did you ever do music themed cocktails? Did you ever get to that?
A lot of theme. I love a good theme. Something anchor me down. Most of the bars and restaurants that I've worked, while I might have influenced a lot of the music, there's been only a few handful of times where I got to curate it. I love making cocktails, but I hate naming them.
The
worst thing. So at Fonda, we would just pick out an ingredient or feeling or whatever it is in English and put it into Spanish. When I was at T-Rex, so it's American barbecue joint, I was just like, well, I can't do that. What am I going to do? And one of the first drinks that I created, using at that time, a very new liquid called Hanger One, and it was their macrat, or at the time they called kefir lime. And it was basically a basil mojito with coconut juice, not coconut water, but the coconut juice, and this vodka, which then I later turned into gin. So it was like a caipirinha mojito, something coconut, but I ended up calling it Kokomo. It just sounded right, right?
Sounded like Kokomo. Yeah.
And I just, every time I made the drink, for better or for worse, I would sing the song.
It's in your head. That is such an earworm.
And The Lion Sleeps Tonight are usually the songs that I love putting in people's heads and then walking away. Which is a game we used to play behind the bar or behind the line when we worked in kitchen, was trying to get somebody to have a song stuck in their head while somebody else is trying to get that song out.
anything to do to just trading earworms the whole time.
So basically, when all else failed and I couldn't name a drink, I just ended up naming them after bad or good pop songs. So we had like the Raspberry Beret, which was a raspberry cosmopolitan, and the Jack and Diane. We have the, you know,
whoa, what was the Jack and Diane?
The Jack and Diane was actually a alcoholic cherry cola.
Okay. Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
So it was a cherry eau de vide. It was a cola syrup that I made with, it was Jim Beam whiskey. And then we force carbonated it.
Nice. Was it served with a chili dog?
No, it should have been served with a chili dog. I didn't know we had a chili dog on the menu. But yeah.
That's amazing. Amazing. So now you find yourself, you're in a whole different world now. You're not bartending anymore. You're educating now. It's all about educating about gin. So I'm guessing that if I were to ask you, tell me three gins I must own at this point in my life, one's going to be Sipsmith. Yeah.
I mean, it's delicious. The reason I have this job, but they're also signing my paychecks. So yes, 100% Sipsmith. For all your gin needs.
Actually, at my bar, we do use Sipsmith. It is something that we've featured and done promotions with and everything. So my bar in LA is a fan of Sipsmith. So far and wide. There you go.
Well done.
Of course. Glad to help.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you got to narrow it down for me. What are you looking for?
Yeah, right? I was going to say, okay, tell me like an Old Tom I should have.
I love Old Tom gins. I love an underdog. So Genevers and Old Toms are my favorites. So my favorite Old Tom is from a distillery in Sweden called Hirno. Their Old Tom is delicious. Sadly, it doesn't come into the US. So that's not helping you any. But it is like one of my favorite. I always joke that if I had enough of it, I would bathe in it.
Yeah,
so good.
You know, my husband and I have come to love Old Toms, you know, just really something so nice and crisp about them. We just love those.
They're just more, I mean, people, like, a lot of people think that they're just sweetened gins, and that's not true.
No, I don't think that.
They could be sweetened, they couldn't, but they were more botanically driven than what we consider a classic or a London dry. So they're just more of it, because at the time, the distillation method of the neutral spirit, the spirit that is made before you put your botanicals into it, was rougher, had more flavoring. So I like to say when I'm teaching people, think of painting on a white canvas versus a gray canvas. If you're painting on a gray canvas, you're going to need more of the other colors for it to come
through. To stand out.
Whereas a white canvas, you don't need as much. So that's why the classic London dry style came about, because rectification or column distillation became very prominent. So the botanicals, you didn't need as much of it. So Old Toms are traditionally more heavily botanically driven. So Old Toms that are available in the United States that I really like, if you ever come across Tanqueray's Old Tom, which is a limited offering, it's delicious. I've threatened them numerous times, especially when I was at Bright Chapel, that if they ever discontinued it, I would never carry any of their other products. That campaign did me no good, and they still discontinued it. And now I have four cases underneath my bed.
So that one comes and goes, is what you're saying. Sometimes they bring it back.
So if you ever see it, if you're in a liquor store and you see it like on the bottom shelf and you're like, what the heck? Definitely get it. It's delicious. As an Old Tom, I really like Bar Hill's Old Tom. So Bar Hill out of Vermont. One of the things that I wouldn't say it's a classic representation of an Old Tom, but I think it's really interesting. So it's made from grain. Their distillery was on an old apiary.
Oh, wow.
And so what they do is, it's the only gin that I'm aware of that has only one botanical in this distillation process. And that one botanical has to be juniper. So it's grain distilled with juniper.
Wow.
And then post-distillation, they add their honey. So all the citrus notes, all the floral notes, everything you get comes from, the honey.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. So they must have their own, they must make their own honey. They must
have their own their vodka, they have a Bar Hill vodka, is actually distilled from honey.
Wow.
So the gin is not, the vodka is. And it's really interesting. It's viscous. I mean, it doesn't, again, it's not what I would think of as a traditional Old Tom, but it's delicious nonetheless.
Incredible. Thank you. I'm writing those down. We're going to give those a try. And one last thing before we wrap this up is, I always have to ask, what is your pairing at home? What gin? Give me a gin and a song. I'm not going to say any gin, because you have so many, but just one example of one gin with one song, or a couple examples. This gin with this song and this gin with this song. You're sitting next to David Bowie right there. So I don't know if that has anything.
Well, as an audiophile, fact that I knew the question was coming,
Of course you did.
But even now that I got here, it's changed like four times. I love the whole album of Sympathique from Pink Martinis. I think every song there is a song that I want to be dressed to the nines in, with a dainty cocktail glass with something in my hand. I'm going to go for the shock and awe factor and say something that's totally, like, when I tell my gin friends and my distilling friends about this globally, they shake their head and they're like, you're just gone off the deep end. There's something very delicious about a gin and Coke.
Gin and Coke.
So yeah, that reaction, usually with a little bit more disdain, is what I get. Distillers.
I didn't think of it, but I'm thinking of a gin and tonic, and then I'm just adding that cola flavor to it.
So here's the thing you got to think about. First of all, gins love carbonation, because the bubbles bring up the citrus and floral notes to the forefront, which is a big part of gin. What is cola if not an aromatic soda? So you have cardamom, you have cola nut, you have cinnamon, cassia, allspice. You have these, they were called aromatic sodas. What is bitters like Angostura and Peychaud's if not aromatics? So the first gin pairing that we think of is called pink gin, which was Plymouth and Angostura. add a little sweetener because of the texture in the body that you don't get because there's no wood sugars in mm-hmm. gin usually, and a little bit of carbonation. And what do you have if not gin and cola? Am I going to do the 2 parts gin and 4 parts cola? Probably not. I might be just do some splash and mm-hmm. figure it out. But a gin and Coke is delicious. It's actually one of my chasers to my favorite gin cocktail of all time, which is the Negroni. So whenever I go out, I get my Negroni, mm-hmm. equal parts or die on the rocks, and a little Coca-Cola back. And it wow. actually, when you pair them together, it actually removes some of the sweetness from the Negroni that you get if they don't dilute properly. So my drink would be a higher proof gin. So maybe like our Sipsmith VJOP, very junipery overproof,
okay.
with cola, while listen to Pulp's Common People.
Ah, oh, that's wonderful.
Because it's like an 8-minute song. It's got this like growing plateau.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I get to that top of that plateau, or I'm actually jumping up and down out of my seat, I've got enough to drink down that I'm not spilling it. And then yep. I have to clean it up later.
Bravo. Bravo. You are such a chef at heart though. I mean, you really, really are. I love it. It's great. Cause there's so much thought and precision to all of that, but I appreciate that very much. It's my borderline OCD. I think, you know, just all that it's, ooh, I love it. And I'll have to do that sometime. I really like it. I really like it. Well, thank you so much. I think that's a perfect way to end it. I feel like we're on a high right now, and it's for me early in the morning. So,
oh yes,
so awesome. Don't go away, but I'm going to turn off the recording. And thank you so much for taking the time. I really
thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Because everybody hates a tourist, especially one who thinks it's all such a laugh. Yeah, and the chip stains of grease will come out in the bath. We will never understand.
Big thanks to Kelly for being not only super rad, but also teaching us about all of the drinks. In fact, that is her Instagram handle. Go follow at all of the drinks, and you can follow her adventures in the cocktail world. You definitely want to try some Sipsmith. It's delicious stuff. We use that at our bar, my bar here in Los Angeles. And also, listen to KALX online. You can do it. I highly recommend it. It's a great station, despite not being able to play Detachable Penis. That's something that'll change, I'm sure. Thank you so much, Kelly. It was so amazing talking with you. And yeah, I hope you all learned a little something. Also, she put together a fantastic noisy, not noisy playlist for us. So head over to the She Be Mo Spotify page so that you can listen to that as well. Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by Barkeeper, a head shop for cocktail lovers, located at 614 North Hoover Street in Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Stop by for barware, vintage glassware, a carefully curated collection of spirits, and one of the most impressive selections of bitters anywhere. Follow them on Instagram and Facebook for information regarding spirits tastings. That's barkeepersilverlake.com. And also in the Virgil Village neighborhood of Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Thank you for tuning in to our barroom chats on Music and Booze with Mo. For more info about today's guest, or if you want to connect with me, check out my Facebook page, Mo Herms. Please subscribe to the podcast and feel free to tell all your friends about it. While you're there, give the show a rating and a review. It really helps to get the word out. If you want to hear the playlists our guests have curated, search She Be Mo on Spotify. SHEBMO. Find pictures of the interviewees and the cool stuff they create on the Music and Booze with Mo Instagram account. Lower your expectations and join us at the bar. Till next time, cheers.